and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. My name is Rob Doster. It is Monday morning, November 19th. We got a good show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy from Fox Sports, Aaron Torres, and we got into everything that happened over the weekend and last week. As always, it is the Monday Overreactions Podcast, and we got a couple of fire takes for you that you are either going to totally agree with or yell at us and throw your phone out the window while you're on the highway listening to this podcast. Before we do all that, and in an effort to try to keep you from throwing your phone out the window, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast and any app that you listen to podcasts in. An interaction that you have with this podcast, whether it's downloading this episode, subscribing to the series, rating it, reviewing it, whatever you do, it really does help us within the metrics, within the rankings. It makes my bosses happy. If my bosses are happy, I'm happy. If I'm happy, you're probably getting a better show. So in reality, rating it, reviewing it, saying nice things about me helps you out in the long run. So if you could do that, if you like what you hear, I would really appreciate it. And now let's get into that conversation with Aaron Torres. And now let me welcome on my buddy from Fox Sports Radio and a contributing writer at The Athletic, one Mr. Aaron Torres. Aaron, what's going on, my man? How you doing?
Rob, I am doing well. We are going to get into this. I know it's a weekend overreactions podcast, but we're recording here on Monday of Feast Week, and I just love this. We're recording here like 2 minutes before this Auburn game is about to tip off at 2:30 on a Monday on the East Coast, and like well, better than waking up having basketball on in the middle of the afternoon.
There is absolutely nothing better than it, man. Look, I've always said this, that the best week of the college basketball season is the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. The second best week is the week of all the conference tournaments, when we basically have from like Tuesday through Sunday night is nothing but wall-to-wall college basketball coverage. The third best week is Feast Week. We go from today, from this moment, I don't think there will be 1 second when there's not college basketball on somewhere for me to watch. And it's going to be great. Hopefully my bank account, my betting account does not drop too far into the negatives. But, you know, I had a nice little win last night, the over in Purdue, Virginia Tech. That was an obvious bet, stealing money. So, yeah, let's do it, man. Here's for winning bets and good basketball.
Yeah, at least the first one. We'll get the second one, I'm sure, too, but the first one's what's most important.
Did you have a chance to watch any of that Purdue-Virginia Tech game? We can probably get into that a little bit, but I just that was as entertaining of a basketball game as I've watched this season. You know, it feels like a lot of the games that have been kind of hyped up heading into the year have not exactly been the most well-played games and the most entertaining games. Like Michigan-Villanova was a blowout. Duke-Kentucky was a blowout. Even like UConn-Syracuse wasn't the kind of game where it went down to the wire and went down to the buzzer. So watching Carson Edwards go back and forth and Nikhil Alexander Walker and Justin Robinson and those guys was a lot of fun, man. I really liked watching that game.
Yeah, I'll be honest. You know, I was actually doing radio during that game, so we had it on one of the monitors. But I while you were saying that, I was thinking, by the way, super random, but how about Illinois-Georgetown? Like, that was a really fun game. And I think it plays into your narrative there that some of the unlikely games have been one of the better ones. I was really high on Virginia Tech coming into the year. I didn't get to watch a ton of this. I will lean on you for my analysis, but I love what Buzz Williams is doing in Blacksburg right now.
Yeah, you had the tweet last night. They haven't been to back-to-back NCAA tournaments since like the 70s or something like that, right? And now they're on the verge of going to their third straight.
Well, Jeff Goodman put out some stats, and so this kind of, for me, stems from, like, before the season when I was doing my ACC predictions, and also, frankly, my Big East predictions and looking at what Steve Wojciechowski has done at Marquette, like, I didn't realize how good Buzz Williams was at Marquette in hindsight. I think he made the second weekend of the tournament three times. And then, you know, we just take for granted that he gets to Virginia Tech and he basically flips it overnight. I think it's year five now, but they made back-to-back NCAA tournaments coming into this year with what is obviously his best team. But I looked up the stats. Virginia Tech is a program, which is kind of amazing with their Big East and now ACC affiliation, has never made three straight NCAA tournaments, which seems like all but a lock. It's been over 50 years since they made the Sweet 16. I don't know if that was technically even the second weekend of the tournament when it happened, but it's been a long time. since they've kind of made it that far. And I think we're looking at some pseudo-historic things going on with Buzz Williams this year.
Yeah, he really does have a very good, very athletic team that can get up and down the floor. They got this kid. So Nickeil Alexander-Walker is a guy that a lot of guys had hyped up as a potential NBA player heading into last season when he was a freshman. And it just didn't all come together for him. Like the shooting stroke wasn't quite there. People thought he was a little bit of a combo and more had more point guard skills, and maybe he did. Consistency was an issue for him, and it just never came together last year. And then this year, he looks like a brand new player, man. Like he's hitting 18-foot step back jumpers. He was banging home threes last night. He was getting to the rim. He's long. He's lanky. He's ambidextrous. So when you throw his performance in and the way that he's been playing this year, with the fact that they have probably the best point guard in the ACC in Justin Robinson, with guys like Ahmed Hill and Kerry Blackshear and those kind of veteran players that just Buzz Williams finds a way to develop over the years, I don't think it's necessarily an overreaction to say that Virginia Tech is going to be on the verge of being a top 10 team all season long, and it's kind of right there in the mix. I don't think they're on the same level as Duke, North Carolina, and Virginia, because I think those might be three of the four or five best teams in the country this season. But I do think it is fair to say that Virginia Tech has kind of set themselves apart a little bit as, you know, right there with Florida State as the two best teams that aren't the big names in that conference.
No, I totally agree. And it's funny, I had you on my podcast a few weeks ago, and I forget if we recorded the day of the Chris Clark news. The day after, I mean, I think most people listening know Chris Clark, basically their best low post player, not really a traditional low post guy, is about 6'6", 6'7", but plays as you know what off, gets suspended, as you referenced on my show, Rob, name removed from the website, the official Virginia Tech roster, which is never a good thing and probably indicative that we shouldn't expect him back this year. But so for them to go to this tournament and you know, not only this game, but also beat a good Northeastern team that beat up on Alabama earlier in the tournament, I was really impressed. And like, I know that it remains to be seen what the deal is with, obviously, I know they lost all those veteran guys off last year's team. Carson Edwards is the only guy back. But as you said, I mean, like this was a team that came in with a lot of hype. The hype died down a little bit with Chris Clark out, and now we're right back where we are. And it's funny because, again, when I go back to my predictions from the preseason, obviously it was with Chris Clark in the lineup, but if you look at their schedule, they only play Duke once, they only play Carolina once. Now they obviously play Virginia twice because that's an in-state rivalry, but the schedule really shapes up nicely for them to potentially finish in the top two, top three in that league. I don't know about top two with Virginia and Duke, but maybe the top three. The point I'm trying to make is I don't know that on paper, head-to-head, when we get to the ACC tournament, that they'll be quote-unquote better than UNC. But I think when you're talking about a team that's going to be right there behind those top two teams, I totally agree with you. I don't think it's an overreaction to say they'll be flirting with the top 10 and maybe the third or fourth seed come ACC tournament time.
Yeah, I don't think that's an overreaction at all. You know, and that's not necessarily on brand for this podcast because we're supposed to get a little bit reckless with these overreactions. So you want to get started with it? I got one to fire things up. You ready?
Let's do it, man.
Jay Wright should be on the hot seat.
Woo! Let's go. I'll be honest. I said this, and I'm just going to lob it right back to you. Maybe not so much now following that Furman loss. That Michigan loss to me was even more surprising than the Kentucky loss to Duke, because Duke, we now know, maybe has the top three picks in the next NBA draft. I think unquestionably has the two best players in the country, and it was on a neutral court. With Villanova, they're at home, the small venue, and it's not as though Michigan is always, gets a team that gets better over the course of the season, but they're far from a finished product. They lose Mo Wagner, and I just never thought that I would live in a world where Nova just gets boat raced, 27 points, not even close. That was a long-winded way of me lobbing it back to you. I know the Furman thing makes the Michigan game look a little bit different, but I look at this Villanova team like, Jay Wright's not on the hot seat. Sorry, I hate to burst your bubble there. I know you're devastated by that, but I don't think it's insane to talk about Villanova as an 8, 9, 10 seed out in the first round of the tournament. And if it wasn't for the Big East being awful this year, like, I don't think it would be inconceivable that they missed the tournament altogether if you want to kind of go with the overreactions kind of element of it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's probably pushing it a little too much to say that they are in danger of missing the NCAA tournament, but they got to get this thing figured out. And I think one of the bigger issues is – so the way that things work for Villanova, right, and the way that Jay Wright has kind of built his program is that he brings in these guys that are like top 40, top 50 kind of players, top 60, four-star prospects that aren't necessarily thought of as one-and-done guys. He brings them in. He lets them kind of marinate in the program for a year or two. By the time they're redshirt sophomores or juniors, they're ready to kind of step into that starring role. By the time they're redshirt juniors or seniors, they end up being all-league or all-conference or all-American players that are ready to try to make a run at the NBA. They're late first-round picks. By the time that they're basically grown adults, you have like a Josh Hart going into the NBA and playing a role for however many years he's going to end up playing. They didn't really have that luxury this year because they lost Dante DiVincenzo and Amari Spellman. So they're left in a situation where they have Eric Pascal and Phil Booth. They're really the only guys that have any kind of meaningful experience on this roster. And you can see it when you watch them. And if you go back and you watch that Michigan game, like everything that Villanova does is kind of based on like a cohesiveness and an interconnectivity sure. that they have within like with each other on that roster because they've played together so much. They've been drilled so well on what they're supposed to do in every given situation, whether it is switching all interchanges on the defensive end of the floor or, you know, driving to the paint, coming to the jump stop if you're the point guard and knowing where somebody's going to cut, where somebody's going to move, where somebody's going to be open, where the help's going to end up coming from kind of a deal. And you could just watch them and see that they're not there yet. And some of that is probably because of the youth they have on the roster. Some of that is because, you know, Javon Quinterly, no matter what happens, he's probably not going to end up being as good as Jalen Brunson was. That's partly because, you know, we watched them last season, and Dante DiVincenzo, who came off the bench, was the 17th pick in the NBA draft. So part of it is that they're young. Part of it is that they just don't have the same kind of talent that they did last season. Now, obviously saying that Jay Wright is on the hot seat is a ridiculous statement, right? Like, I get that. I know people on Twitter right now are kind of getting on me because they didn't get the joke. But I do think that it is fair to criticize the job that he has done coaching them this season, specifically because, okay, in the loss to Furman or in the loss to Michigan, like, Javon Quinterly made a ton of mistakes. There were switches that he missed. There were guys that were left wide open for layups that were his fault. Like, if you go back and watch the tape, he had some really bad moments. He obviously did not handle the ball pressure of Xavier Simpson all that well. I think that Cole Swider had some of the same issues. I think that you can put some of that on Demir Cosby. Like, they're young guys, just they were a mess on the defensive end against Michigan. And the result was, against Furman, Javon Quinterly didn't play a minute. He is their five-star freshman. He didn't play a minute. Cole Swider played 7 minutes. Sadiq Bey played 10 minutes. Brandon Slater didn't play a single minute. That's their four-man freshman class right there. And where I think he might be messing up is he needs his guys to have experience, right? Because it's clear that the players he has, like, if you're starting Colin Gillespie and you're losing at home to Furman, I think that should be a sign that Colin Gillespie probably isn't good enough to play at the level you need him to play to be the Villanova that we all expect, right? At least not yet.
Sure.
Same thing with Jermaine Samuels. So if you're playing these older guys and they're not getting the job done, but on the other hand, like, you're not playing the kids, you're not giving Quinterly a chance to go out there and figure it out, then I think that's where he's messing up, and that's where he can probably, you know, he deserves a little bit of criticism and a little bit of second guessing. And you know, I'm not one. Jay Wright's a Hall of Fame basketball coach. I'm just some dickhead with a podcast. But I do think that it's fair to say, if you're not going to throw your freshman to the fire and try to get an experience, how are they going to learn? How are they going to figure it out? Because it's clearly what you have right now is not good enough to get it done.
One, I'm just a dickhead with a podcast. I've never heard a more accurate description of you. Should get that printed up, put it on a T-shirt, make a little money off this puppy, besides the advertising and stuff, too. So I totally agree that you got to get the freshmen playing time, because whether it's this year or next year, they're going to be contributors. And as you said, it's not as though this is the years past where maybe you bring in a freshman that's ready to compete, but oh, by the way, he's got juniors and seniors that are going to be in the NBA or at the very least all Big East caliber players ahead of them. Let me kind of flip it on you, and I'm curious because I know you're in the Northeast, you're around that program a lot. I'm out here on the West Coast, but you know, I was having dinner the other night with a coach and who is from the East Coast and knows the scene down there really well. And what we were talking about was with Villanova, how incredible it is that they have basically hit on all their targets in recruiting, gotten as they want, develop them. And my buddy, you know, he listed off all the obvious names, Josh Hart, Dante DiVincenzo, Jalen Brunson. I mean, they're all from that D.C., Delaware, Philly, Mid-Atlantic area. The point that I brought up to him is what's amazing to me, you bring in all those guys, some of them from prominent AAU programs, some of them not, and every single one hits, but that you throughout this process of play of keeping guys kind of on the bench and in the system 2, 3, 4 years – you've kept all the AAU and high school coaches happy. And, you know, look, for people who don't know, and you know this, Rob, but, you know, behind the scenes, when you have a certain caliber of player, there's kind of this explicit understanding that whether the guy is ready to contribute or not, like, you got to play him. Like, you got to play him. Doesn't really matter. Like, you got to play him. And it happens at Arizona. It happens at Kentucky. It happens at Duke. And it happens at UCLA, you go on and on. So what I'm trying to get at is, how do you think going forward, like, does it matter that Javon Quinterly didn't play a single minute of this game? Because Javon Quinterly, I don't know where he is talent-wise, but he's one of the most high-profile recruits that Jay Wright has ever signed, and certainly in the past 4, 5, 6 years. I'm just curious what you think the message that it potentially sends down the road. Because like I said, Villanova has done an incredible job of keeping those AAU high school coaches happy where they're continually sending their guys to Jay Wright. But those were also guys that nobody expected to play right away. And you look at a kid like Javon Quinterly, kind of a YouTube legend, Instagram star, sitting on the bench. Like, I know Villanova has their system, but Javon Quinterly didn't come to Nova or go anywhere to sit on the bench for 40 minutes.
Well, what I would say to that is that Jay Wright's made this mistake before, right? If you remember what happened after the first Final Four that he reached in, what was it, 2009, they started being able to get in the door with recruits that they weren't able to talk to. They started getting interest from guys that they weren't necessarily getting interest from before that. And there was a switch, and Jay Wright will admit this. If you ask him today, he will admit this for you. You know, people on that staff that I've spoken to admitted this to me. Guys that were on that team, that played on those teams, admitted this to me, that they said, we started recruiting a different kind of guy. We stopped paying attention to whether or not they fit what we wanted and the culture that we wanted to build, and we just started going out and getting the most talented players. And we just started going out and trying to get top 20, top 25, five-star guys. And what happened was when they got to campus and all of a sudden it's this, okay, maybe I'm not going to be playing as a freshman. Maybe I'm going to have to spend time to develop. I got to accept the role, all this kind of stuff. When they got there, they were like, this is not what I signed up for. You didn't tell me about this. So there was turmoil there. And what's happened is Wright has focused on going back to his roots and recruiting the guys that fit that quote-unquote Villanova culture, right? The Villanova way, the Ryan Archie Diaconos, the Josh Harts, the guys that are going to be okay sitting the bench for a year or two, somebody like a Mikhail Bridges who will play a role for a year or two, somebody like a Jalen Brunson who, you know, comes in as a top 15 McDonald's All-American out of Chicago that is at Villanova, and he's playing like, he wasn't playing behind Ryan Arcidiacono, but Ryan Arcidiacono was the point guard on the team when they won that national title when he was a freshman. He could have gone basically anywhere else in the country and started. So my answer, I guess, is that what Jay Wright has done his homework. He's found the kids that have clearly been okay playing a role and known that they're coming in and they're only going to be playing maybe 8, 9, 10 minutes as a freshman if they don't end up redshirting. And he's gotten those guys because he did his research on them. And I'm assuming that if he did the same with with Javon Quinterly, if he did that with Cole Swider, with Brandon Slater, with all these guys, and he has them coming in and they are not playing, they came to this program with the understanding that this is a possibility that could happen if they didn't pick it up right away. Now, I don't think that they were anticipating sitting on the bench for the entire game while they lost at home to Furman. And to be clear, I don't know if there was something else that happened. Maybe Javon Quinterly talked back when he didn't play against Michigan. Maybe there was something else there. I do not know. I did not get an answer on that when I asked. So I guess the answer to your question is he gets guys that he knows are going to be able to buy in because he does the research and he puts in the time and he figures out who the players are that he's bringing into his program. And it'll be interesting to see. It's one thing to do that while it's winning. It's another thing when you don't necessarily have that talent. So that is definitely something to keep an eye on. Let me ask you this, and then we can kind of go into some of your overreactions. But I don't think that there is a top 25 team in the Big East. And I'm currently sitting here looking at all the teams in the conference, and I'm wondering, how many are they going to get in the tournament? If I set the over-under at 3.5 right now, what would you take?
Well, I would take the under, to be honest. And, you know, I was kind of tongue-in-cheek joking with somebody the other day, like, Big East, you know, best one-bid league in the history of college basketball here, because that's the way it's trending. You know, look, I think you and myself and everybody who loves this sport and kind of covers it and pays attention 365 days a year, I think we all thought it could be down. But some of the results are just flat out shocking. Is, you know, Providence losing to Wichita State early in the season on a neutral court. We've talked about Nova. Xavier, the final score didn't reflect it, but they got beat up pretty bad by Wisconsin. You know, Georgetown, they have that great win against Illinois, which I mentioned. But by the way, Illinois didn't have their best player. Maybe it wasn't quite as good. They go to the Jamaica tournament or wherever they were, and they lose to Loyola Marymount. And I live on the West Coast, and I'm not far from Loyola Marymount. They might be improved. I mean, if that's one of the top 200 teams in college basketball, I'll be shocked.
So your take on that is 100% correct. They're not very good. That was a really bad loss for Georgetown.
Well, and I was going to say, the crazy part is not to – I know you brought me on my hard-hitting Loyola Marymount takes here, but Loyola actually has a kid named Eli Scott who actually played with the Ball brothers, Lonzo, LiAngelo, and LaMelo when they were at Chino Hills High School. He was the fourth of, you know, obviously five starters, and he's probably their best player. He averaged double figures as a freshman last year, and he didn't even play against Georgetown, which is the insane part. So anyways, you know, I'm off Loyola's soapbox here, and you know, we'll save the Loyola talk for later. But the point is this league has taken a lot of bad losses, and some of them are explainable. Marquette losing in Indiana gets hot, whatever. But by the way, St. John's hasn't looked good. As I said, Providence. And I do think, and you know, as you and I talk, we're getting ready for the start of this Maui Invitational. Like, Xavier, I think, could have major problems. Providence, young and talented, but could have major problems. And so, yeah, I think if you set it at 3.5 right now, I got to take the under because, I think this league might profile a lot like the Big Ten last year where they're just not going to do – there's going to be teams that just don't do enough in the out-of-conference to warrant serious consideration once we get towards tournament time.
Yeah, and the big thing was that we just kind of assumed that Villanova was going to be at the top of the league that could kind of lift all – you know, every time that they played someone in the conference, it would lift their computer profile and lift their computer numbers and make everything look a little bit better. Well, it looks like Villanova might not be a top 25 team. So all of a sudden we're looking at a situation where I don't think there's a top 25 team in that league. And I do think that there are, you know, I would say that Xavier, Providence, St. John's, Marquette, Butler, and Villanova all still look like they have a chance to get to the tournament. But I don't know if I would bet on more than half of them getting there. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, man. And to your point, they won three out of 10 in the Gavitt games. And the teams that won in the Big East was Georgetown won at Illinois, who is at the bottom of the Big Ten. DePaul beat Penn State at home. Penn State's at the bottom of the Big Ten. And then it was – who was the last one? There was another one that wasn't impressive. And I'm blanking. This is great podcasting right here, by the way.
I know.
Excellent work by us.
I know. Great prep, right?
Oh, it was really St. John's winning at Rutgers. St. John's won at Rutgers. And breaking news.
Who could forget?
Breaking news, Rutgers is not very good at basketball. I don't know if you knew that, Aaron.
I was going to say, who could forget that classic St. John's-Rutgers game that we'll all be telling our grandchildren about 30 years from now? So
Exactly. All right, you got any overreactions for me?
All right, so I know you want to talk about UConn, their week at the Garden. So I'll just jump to it. I have some other overreactions.
Give me the other ones first, because everyone's going to want to listen to our UConn banter. So if we put it at the end, maybe people will listen to the entire podcast.
Fantastic. Well, first, they better. But I will say this. I am going to overreact on the Arkansas Razorbacks, baby. I think they are going to finish right behind that top tier in the SEC, and we all love that top five in the SEC: Kentucky, Tennessee, Auburn, Mississippi State, and LSU. I think with Alabama down, with Florida down, with Vandy, I'm still lukewarm on Vandy. Arkansas coming off that big win against Indiana, in which Indiana didn't have a bunch of players, but we don't have to talk about that, gets into the tournament a year after basically losing their whole team except for Daniel Gafford. What do you say, Rob?
Well, I love it, because that is exactly the kind of ridiculous overreaction that I'm looking for on this podcast. But I will say this. I don't think it's quite as crazy as maybe other people are going to believe. I was way down on this group heading into the season, because for a couple of reasons. One, you know, outside of Daniel Gafford, like I don't think I could have named a single player that like was on that roster heading into the season. They basically lost like everyone that was notable. And two, they didn't bring in anybody that would make you say, okay, wow, there's you know, they don't have Emmanuel Quickly and Ashton Hagens and EJ Montgomery and all these five stars coming in, right? So it was basically Daniel Gafford and nobody else. And Daniel Gafford, you know, I watched him a bunch last season, and he's not necessarily a guy that is like, he's not Michael Porter, right? He's not somebody that you could just run out there and you're going to say he's going to get you 22 every single night because you just give him a rock, he's going to get a shot up. He's not like that kind of a guy. He's like a Robert Williams, kind of Clint Capela. What makes him so intriguing as an NBA prospect is he's a rim protector. He's a ridiculous athlete. He's switchable defensively. He's a rim runner in ball screens. He does a lot of things without the ball that makes him very, very effective. So you're going to combine the fact that they lose everyone, they don't really have anyone all that great coming in, and their best player, their superstar, their lottery pick is a guy that is not necessarily – you want him to be a role player. That's a bad combination of things for a team heading into the season. So that's kind of where I was at with it. But watching him play, whoa, he got better. Like, he was scoring in the post. He had one play that really stood out to me was he got it kind of thrown to him in the short corner, and he was in the post, and he reverse pivoted, and he squared up, and he hit a jumper, and I want to say it was Devin Davis's face. And I was just like, okay, if he's going to make that shot, if he's got that in his bag now, then this becomes a very different conversation about what he could end up being as a player. So I guess my long-winded way of saying your overreaction, I don't think is a crazy overreaction, just a slight overreaction.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, part of it is, first of all, I think you laid out why, and by the way, I love, you know, what Mike Anderson has done there. I think it's actually a little bit underrated. But you made all the arguments for why everyone thought that Arkansas was really going to struggle this year. I mean, it is pretty simple in that they lost six seniors off last year's team. They made back-to-back NCAA tournaments. And outside of Gafford, they didn't return anybody. By the way, they had a McDonald's All-American who decommitted and ended up at Mississippi State. So, you know, I was a little down on them too. But I think it's a couple things. First of all, I just think, you know, they're just flat out better than we thought. People forget they opened against Texas. And Texas, who probably has the second most talent in the Big 12. Now, I don't know if it's going to equate to wins and losses, but, you know, Texas needed a three-pointer basically at the buzzer to force overtime and win, and a bunch of Arkansas misses down the stretch there. So, I mean, all of a sudden you're talking about an Arkansas team that could be, whatever, 3-0, 4-0 right now with a neutral court win against Texas and a nice win against Indiana at home. But what I like about them and their kind of potential to make a tourney run here is I like some things that are kind of, you know, nothing that really equates to yesterday, right? I think, first of all, we saw yesterday Bud Walton Arena remains one of the best home court venues in the SEC. They've always been able to win games there, even when the talent hasn't been very good. And now, as you mentioned, Gafford looks a lot better. They're getting contributions from a lot of these freshmen that I don't think anybody was expecting. The kid Isaiah Joe, I love the kid's just fearless. He's not afraid to take big shots. You know, some go out. I think he went 3-for-11 from three yesterday, but he's not afraid to take those shots. The other thing is, You know, and Rob, last year you and I, we did this a lot, but I was really high on the Big 12 the SEC last year, and I really thought top to bottom it was the best conference in college basketball. And, you know, some people liked me for it, some people hated me for it, but I still do believe that it was a really tough conference every single night. But you look at the SEC this year, whether it's Ole Miss, Georgia, Texas A&M, I'm trying to think, Missouri without Michael Porter, or without Jonte Porter, excuse me, South Carolina not playing very well right now. There are wins to be had in this conference. So if they can steal a win or two against one of those top teams, Mississippi State or LSU at home, and then be up on the bottom of the SEC, like, I don't think it's inconceivable that, you know, they finish, say, 11-7, 10-6 in this league, and then all of a sudden you add a win against Indiana to the resume. You get maybe one of those wins against the top 15-25 range team, and all of a sudden you got yourself a nice little resume come Selection Sunday.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because, and this is going to a good way to segue into the Big Ten, is that I think Indiana, like, that one is only going to look better and better and better. For one, they have a lot of young pieces on that roster, man. Like, Romeo Langford can go out there and score. He had 22-10-5 against Arkansas, but he did a lot of very dumb things on the defensive end. Like, he's not where he needs to be on that end of the floor. And, like, look, he's a freshman that played 4 games. I get it. He's going to get better. Archie Miller knows how to coach defense, but he's going to have to coach a lot of defense with Romeo Langford there. And the other part of it is they were missing two starters, right? Like, they were missing four bodies, four players that are going to be in that rotation. And you combine all of that with the fact that they were playing on the road at Bud at Walton Arena, which is a very, very tough environment against a team that likes to get out and press. And they came within a missed layup and a missed tip-in with 5 seconds left, which was then followed by a foul as Devin Davis was fighting for a rebound. That's how they ended up losing, right? Like, the game was tied with 5 seconds left, and they missed a layup and a tip-in that would have put them ahead, and instead ended up fouling while there was a loose ball, and that's why they lost. So, to me, that was a promising performance from Indiana. And the other part about it, that loss is the worst loss that any of the tourney-caliber teams in the Big Ten has taken so far this year. Like, the only other loss, I'm not going to count Penn State, I'm not going to count Illinois, and I'm not going to count Rutgers losing, because, like, who cares about them, right? They're at the bottom of the conference. They don't matter. The other losses that Big Ten teams have taken this year, Michigan State lost by 5 to then number 1 Kansas in the Champions Classic, and Purdue, which looks like a top 25 team, lost to Virginia Tech, who we just talked about in the finals of the Charleston Classic. So, this might be a take, this might be an overreaction, but I think we might be looking at 10 teams getting in the tournament from the Big Ten. And the reason I say that, and the reason I think I'm justified in saying it, is that the Atlantic 10 is only going to get one bid. The American, I don't know if we're going to get two bids out of that conference, right? The Big East, how many bids are you going to get out of that league? Pac-12, how many are you going to get out of that league? Like, the bids have to come from somewhere, and the bottom of the SEC isn't all that good, and the bottom of the ACC isn't all that good. And the Big Ten has 10 teams that look like they're pretty good. And they are just cleaning up in the non-conference, man. So give me your Big Ten take. And did we all miss when we said that the Big Ten wasn't going to be very good at the top this year? Because it looks like we missed.
One, we certainly missed. And two, it's kind of funny, because as I was watching those Gavitt games, you know, I just mentioned the SEC last year, why I love that league so much. You know, Ole Miss, finished last place in the SEC. They beat 4 NCAA tournament teams in conference last year. So the reason I bring it up is because I think the Big Ten profiles a lot like the SEC last year, where is there a national championship contender at the top? No. But if you go down the list, you start naming these teams outside of maybe one or two at the bottom. I mean, where do the easy wins come from in this league? And so I think what's been most impressive to me, you know, it's not – the Indianas, who obviously we're talking about an Indiana loss, but you know, Indiana, it's not Michigan State. It's a team like Ohio State that, I mean, you know, Chris Holtmann, like, I don't think people realize everything that this guy has done in, you know, whatever it is, 40 or so games at that school, but to open the season with a true win, you know, a true road win at Cincinnati, and I know Cincinnati's a little bit down this year, but they just opened a new arena, renovated arena, and that was their first home game in that place, and that place was rocking. They find a way to win. They go to Creighton, another team that's down in the Big East, but that is a tough venue to play in. And so you look at an Ohio State getting those quality wins. You look at Michigan beating up on Villanova and Providence, where I think, you know, if you had asked most of us, say, 6 weeks ago, you know, I think most people would have thought, hey, a split there would be good, or even 2 or 3 weeks ago would be good. You know, you look at Wisconsin going to Xavier, and again, we don't know how good some of the competition is, but like, Cintas Center is not an easy place to play, and Wisconsin dominated for about 36 minutes before they kind of fell apart late. So I don't think it's an overreaction to say that they're going to get a ton of teams. Now, 10 feels like a lot, I'm not going to lie, but you also bring up the really important point of the bids have to come from somewhere. And you know, the Big East, like we said, it could be a 2-3 bid league. The A-10, you know, all those teams have taken weird losses early. George Mason returned everybody. I thought they were going to be pretty good, has taken some strange losses. The AAC, as we just mentioned, Cincinnati already has a loss. Wichita has some, you know, has a weird loss early. I don't think it's an exaggeration, and I do think it's going to be one of those that the casual college basketball fan comes in the middle of you know, late February, early March, and they see a team from the Big Ten, and they're 21-12, and they're a ninth place in the league, and you say, how is that team on the bubble right now? And then you're going to look at that team, their resume, and you're going to go back to right where we are now, November, December, and say, well, wait a second. They picked up some good wins, and everybody they played picked up some good wins. I got to be honest, I don't think it is crazy at all to say we're talking whatever it ends up being, 8, 9, 10 teams from this league.
Yeah, and the only thing that I would quibble with in that take is that the Big Ten doesn't have a national title contender. I firmly believe that Michigan is a national title contender. And just real quick, the reason why is simple, right? They are an elite defense, and I don't think there's any arguing that. I think they're number one right now in KenPom, even though a lot of that has to do with stuff from last season. But, you know, you watch the way they get out and guard. Xavier Simpson and Charles Matthews are absolute dogs, right?
Sure.
John Teske is underrated in the way that he can move and what he provides on the defensive end of the floor. But they can also play Iggy Brazdikas and Isaiah Livers together at the four and the five, which gives them like the kind of mobile matchup proof lineup that most coaches are looking for as teams go smaller and smaller and smaller. So you take that elite defense and combine it with the fact that you have John Beilein on that sideline, and you're getting to give him 4 months to figure out how to get that team to be able to score the way that they need to be able to score. And I mean, that's a team. I'm not saying that I'm going to predict them to win. I'm not saying that I have anything more than like $5 invested in a future on them at plus 3,500 right now. But I will say that I don't think it's crazy. Well, I think it's crazy to pick anyone other than Duke to win the national title right now. But assuming that like, if we're not putting Duke into that conversation, I don't think it's crazy to say that Michigan is right there with some of those other teams. I mean, they are really, really good.
Yeah, no, and it's totally fair. And a couple things on Michigan really quick is, one, I mean, I kind of referenced it earlier, and I mean, I think I'm pretty right, is John Beilein's teams aren't usually this good this early in the year, and it's in late February, early March when they get hot. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, but a few years ago when that near plane crash happened, and you know, thankfully everybody was okay, they were like an 8 seed in the Big Ten tournament that year. And like the reason that they were taking off then was because they had a noon tip off the next day and had to get to, I think the tournament was in Washington, D.C. for some reason, but they had to get to the Big Ten tournament. You know, last year they finished whatever it was, fourth in the Big Ten. They weren't even the best team in their own state because Michigan State was there, and they get hot at the right time, go to the Final Four. So I think there's that. And then, like you said, just John Beilein's ability to develop not only his team but his guys, it's crazy because – the kid you mentioned, Iggy Brazdikas, or however you say his name, you know, I saw him probably about 4 or 5 months ago.
Hold on. Can you say his name again?
Well, I just kind of turned into one word because I had no idea. I just kind of emphasized Iggy, and then I just kind of mumbled the rest. So yeah, was it Brazdikas? Is that how you say it?
That was actually
it was like Iggy Brazdikas, like that. You know, it's like one of those guys.
Brazdikas.
Brazdikas? Okay.
Braz.
I'm sorry. Well, I feel terrible.
Braz. Day.
Okay, I'm writing this down right now. I don't.
Brazdeikis. Brazingis.
Okay.
I'm the absolute worst when it comes to pronouncing names. So
how
I
do
could,
you say
I
it?
Could laugh. Brazdeikis. I'm not cutting this out, by the way. I'm leaving this in.
No, please do. Listen, I just want to know, you know, to Iggy and his family, I know they're big listeners of this show, and I do want to apologize for not being prepared before I came on. So to Iggy Brazingis and, you know, his whole family, I do want to apologize. I want to get to a good point, by the way. I hope I can still get there. But, like, dude, I saw this guy at the Nike Hoop Summit probably in April. What was that, 6 months ago? He was just a dude. And I know that it was all the best high school players in the country and from different parts of the globe. But like of the 30 guys there, I would put him in the bottom 5, 6, 8 of guys that like I thought were going to be something going forward. And, you know, I looked at him. I said, okay, maybe in 3 or 4 years down the road, this is a guy that can do some things. But like, you know, this is a guy that's being a contributor. And then as you mentioned, all the other guys, you know, I probably should even take that back. He's not just a contributor, he's a second leading scorer. But then you add in all the other guys that you mentioned, Jordan Poole, Xavier Simpson, and then, of course, Charles Matthews, who's phenomenal. I guess that's fair. I hadn't really thought of them as a national championship contender. But, I mean, look, they're already in the top 10. They got one of probably the 3, 4, 5 best X's and O's tactician guys in basketball. I guess I don't think it's that much of a – I don't think it's an exaggeration at all now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, and look, the other thing about Iggy is that he's got that same mentality that Charles Matthews and Xavier Simpson have, where they are just absolute dogs, absolute pit bulls, and got a little bit – I mean this in a good way. They got a little bit of a screw loose when it comes to their competitiveness. So you put those three guys on the floor together, and like you got a team that's going to be ready to fight and scrap it out at every single second. But let's move on, because I do want you to be able to talk a little bit about UConn and what you think of the Danny Hurley era, 4 games in, what you made of the win over Syracuse. Give me all the takes. We could talk a little bit about Syracuse here as well.
Sure. Yeah. For people who don't know, I am a graduate of the University of Connecticut, class of 07. Shout out to me. And I grew up in Connecticut. Who loved the Huskies, kind of known as the UConn Homer guy in the media. And look, what, you know, I'll keep it in terms of the takes to start, but like what Dan has done is absolutely incredible. And you know, I said this on my own podcast earlier this week, is that this what people don't realize, this isn't John Calipari coming in and to Kentucky and bringing John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins and Eric Bledsoe. This is the exact same team, added a grad transfer or two that was not even a contributor, like a major contributor where they came from. And Dan Hurley is completely the script. And like, I don't know if like this team's going to make the tournament and how far can they go? And like, obviously a lot of UConn fans are already hitting me up. I'm sure they're hitting you up, Rob. What is the ceiling for this team? I don't know. Obviously, as we know, the shooting was out against Syracuse. It certainly wasn't that way against Iowa, but I'll say this, man, is like, you know, Dan Hurley, I think, became the most memeable coach in college basketball over the last 4 or 5 days. First with the Jalen Adams thing, chest bumping on the sidelines. Then he made a little sad, pouty face on the sidelines. Iowa thrown out of that game. Like, that is the kind of guy, and it's so cliche because obviously Jim Calhoun, Hall of Famer, was there 30-whatever years. But, like, that is UConn basketball is. And growing up in Connecticut, you become used to a certain style of play from UConn. You're not always going to be the most talented, because if you look at Jim Calhoun's teams, a lot of times they weren't the most talented, but they're tough. They're going to outwork you. They're going to defend their you-know-whats. They're going to play hard. And that was something that was just lacking from the program over the last couple of years. And so to see Dan Hurley step in year one, I know you were in the arena, Rob, but I thought Fraschilla brought up the point of so many coaches use the excuse of, well, you know, wait till I get my guys in. It's like, no, Dan Hurley's like, these are my guys. The guys I have now are my guys. And to see the transformation, the way they play, the way they look, the way they compete physically, how some of them have changed in the strength and conditioning program, I just think it's an unbelievable testament to Dan Hurley and what he's done in 6 or 8 months on the job.
Yeah, it's the fact that he has these guys playing so hard for him. And the way he just – I had a long conversation with Jalen Adams, and I was able to talk with Dan at the AAC Media Day. And one of the things that, like, he drove home was when he first got into the program – it was kind of like the phrase that he's – I mean, he's used this phrase, like, multiple times, is that, like, the players on the team were, like, animals – abused animals in a shelter. Like, they were just – they were broken. Yeah. And he had to kind of – his goal was to build them back up and get to the point where they love basketball again. Because when you lose so much and you lose the way that they lost over the course of the last 2 years, one – basketball doesn't become fun anymore. Two, your confidence just gets sapped. And like, I know there are people out there that are like, oh, no hot hand, none of this, none of that, whatever. But like, life is confidence. And if you're not a confident basketball player, if you're not a confident athlete, then you might as well just not even show up. And so he got them loving the game again. He got them competing again. He got their confidence back. He taught them how to win. He built them from the ground up, and he got them playing hard for him. And like, apparently when he's in practice, he is just an absolute maniac. Like, he doesn't let these guys, like, the thing with Jalen Adams, right? Like, the phrase that they kept using was hang dog faces. Like, you know those old cartoons with, like, the sad hounds and like, their faces are hanging down. And he said he didn't want any hang dog faces when people came into his practices and came into the games and you know, when things weren't going the right way. And so one of the things he's done with Jalen is he's basically said, like, look, I don't care how tired you are. I don't want you sitting out of a single drill. I want you to fight through it. I want you to play through it. I want you to be the leader. I want you to be the guy that these guys on your roster look to and look and understand and use as leadership. And, you know, he's done that. And he's got Jalen Adams playing hard. Like, Jalen, it's never been a talent issue with Jalen, right? It's been a, is he used the right way, one, and is he going to play hard for 40 minutes kind of deal, too. And he's got him playing hard. He's got Al-Tariq Gilbert back playing hard. He's got Christian Vitale playing hard. Like, the most impressive thing about that the game against Iowa is, like, look, they got their asses kicked, man. Like, let's call a spade, right? Like, they just got beat. Iowa's a better basketball team. It was a bad matchup. All things considered, like, that was probably the way it was always going to play out. But those dudes left it all on the floor, even though they were trailing by like 15 to 20 points the entire second half. They never had a shot in the second half. And to see the effort that they gave was unbelievable. Like, that's the kind of thing that you dream as a coach, right? Even if you're not good enough, even if you're like talent deficient, and I'm not saying they are, but I'm just saying, like, you want your guys to fight like that. And the other part of it, and you could tell me if you think this is fair, is that his guys know that he is going to fight for them just as hard.
Yep.
You know, he got himself ejected. I don't think that it was – he wanted to get the first tee. And then after he got the first tee, it was very clear that he had no problem getting ejected from that game. Even though he told me afterwards it was the first time that he's ever been ejected in college. I don't know if that's true. I didn't fact check it, but I'm just going to trust that that he's speaking the truth there. And he tried to, man. Like, it was absolutely hilarious. I wasn't even watching the game for most of the second half. I was just watching him. There was a point – halfway through the second half when there was the TV timeout and he was not happy with the call. And as everyone else was setting up the huddle, like, he just walked over straight to the ref and said, I want you to tell me what happened there. It was a foul. I want you to explain to me what happened there. And so he was doing everything he could to get thrown out of that game. And I think he kind of proved to his guys that, you know, if they fight for him, he's going to fight for them just as hard.
Yeah. And it's funny because in his opener, I'm blanking on who they even played, but the first game, it was at Gamble Pavilion, which is obviously UConn's, you know, on-campus venue. And I think everybody's trying to get a feel for who is this guy and what is he about. And at some point in the second half, I don't even remember who the player was off the top of my head. It might have been Eric Cobb, but somebody dove into the stands for a loose ball. I'm trying to think, maybe it was Polly. I can't remember. But, you know, the camera zooms into the stands. And out of nowhere, you see this lightning bolt, which is Dan Hurley sprinting from the bench to the stands to help his guy up. He beat his own players to the guy in the stands. And to me, that told me everything, Rob. It's like, again, I don't know what the ceiling is. I don't know, is this a tournament team? Whatever. But it told me, it's like, dude, if you want a group of guys to buy into you and what you're saying and what you're doing, they got to know you have your back. And you know, you talk to coaches, Rob, I talk to coaches. So much of coaching is just having the trust of your guys. And I think, one, it was skewed 8 in the Kevin Ollie era, and like, you know, I'm not throwing dirt on his grave here because look, that, you know, we all know what happened and all that, but you know, the sourcing that I had from within the program was that he was afraid to coach these guys. He was afraid to push these guys. They had had guys leave early for the NBA draft. They had had a bunch of guys transfer, and he felt like if I push these guys, you know, they're all going to leave if I push them too hard. And it's, and you know, everyone was telling me that was around the program, like, it's actually the exact opposite. Kids want to be coached. They want to be pushed hard. They just want to know that, that you got their back. And to see exactly that from Dan Hurley early on, and to see, like you said, the players have bought in. I'll tell you this. I thought it was a great sign in the offseason that a lot similar actually to Louisville and Chris Mack is that, you know, Dan Hurley inherited – just as you said, as you alluded to, just a mess of a program, different from Louisville. Obviously, Louisville won more games over the last couple of years, but a mess of a program, a place where the expectations coming in, like if you're a player going into the program, the expectations have not been met at all. It's been disappointing in both places. And with Chris Mack at Louisville, with UConn and Dan Hurley, I thought it was a great testament to both coaches that nobody really left, that everybody bought in. As you said, Jalen Adams, he's a guy, you know, that he could have found a spot somewhere else. Al Tariq Gilbert, you know, who knows with him because he's been injured. But, like, all these guys stuck around. All these guys bought into whatever it is that he's selling behind closed doors. I just think it's an unbelievable testament to him, and I think it's a great sign if you're a UConn fan going.
Yeah, and one of the things that I was told is that Hurley didn't really go after – he has 13 scholarship players on the roster, and he didn't really go after Mustafa Heron simply because he wanted to prove a point that these were his guys and he wasn't going to run somebody out. Now, let's say Mustafa Heron shows up and says, I'm not looking anywhere else. I want to go to UConn. Maybe that conversation would have been different. I don't know how heavily he really looked at UConn, but I do know that he took the when he made the transfer to St. John's, he looked heavily at going to Fairfield simply because like his mother really, really is sick and she really, really yep. is not doing well. And there's no – like that waiver was a good waiver to get him back home closer to his family. And St. John's is like a 45-minute train ride away from I believe his family – they either live in Fairfield or West Haven. I can't remember which one it is. But regardless, like – there was very good reason for him to be able to move back there. And from what I was told is that it was like St. John's was the team and Fairfield was the other team. So I believe that there was some merit to the idea that Dan Hurley wasn't going to run somebody off just to bring a transfer in. And I think that when you would do that, I think that proves a lot to the guys that you have on your roster. And it kind of sets a tone for the program and the culture that you have, right? And I think that makes sense. Let's talk a little bit about Syracuse real quick. I'm sure you have no problem rubbing a little bit of dirt on that grave if you're a UConn fan. But I think that there are some bigger issues at play, although I do want to see what happens when they get Franklin Howard back before I start saying that, yeah, they were overrated and we never should have ranked them in the first place.
I totally agree, and that was like the big reaction I saw from a couple people, including people that I like, by the way, is that like, oh, you know, Syracuse, they're fine when they don't have expectations, and then the second they get expectations, first of all, they haven't really been that good in the regular season, even when they haven't had expectations the last few years. But, you know, I think they caught the wrong UConn team on the wrong night, and I say this as a UConn guy, but the way that UConn shot the ball in that game, that is just not something that is replicable. Obviously, because UConn couldn't hit the broadside of a barn from deep three against Iowa a night later. So for that Q's give up, you know, a bunch of three-pointers, UConn shot close to 60% in that game. I just don't think it's something that you're going to see a lot from the opponents that Syracuse plays. And then with Oregon, Oregon's a really good team. And I know you know this, Rob, but for people who don't, like, follow college basketball or don't follow West Coast hoops, I know the focus is on Bol Bol. They got a lot of dudes at Oregon. They probably have the most talented roster in college basketball. Now, I still don't think Syracuse kind of playing in their pseudo home away from home. I don't think it's a great thing for them to lose back-to-back games. But I think on the flip side is, like you said, they weren't at full strength. You lose that opener where everything goes right for UConn, and then you got to come back and play whatever time it was, Rob. You would know, you know, 4 p.m, 5 p.m. I mean, call me crazy, but I'm guessing the Garden wasn't exactly rocking for that second game the way that it would have been if Syracuse could have gotten a win on Thursday night.
Yeah, it wasn't as quiet. And while I do think that there is talent on Oregon, they were missing Louis King, And I don't know if you actually meant the most talented roster in the country, but I'm going to give that one to Duke, and I'll let you
have it. Did I say country?
Yeah.
I meant Pac-12.
Pac-12. Okay, yeah. All right, that makes a lot more sense.
No, I don't think – no.
Yeah, I was going to say, Aaron, it's too early to be drinking, man. It's not even noon West Coast time.
It's Overreaction Monday. Let's go. Victor Bailey.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
There you go. All right, so the last thing I'll say about Syracuse, and then I'll let you get out of here because I've already kept you – about 30 minutes longer than I told you I was going to keep you, is that...
I talk a lot.
Yeah, you do. I talk a lot, too, so it's a bad combination when we get together. Always fun, though. The one thing I will say about them is this. O'Shea Brissett is not going to shoot as poorly as he shot the first four games of the season. Like, he's better than what he's been. He's missed a lot of the shots that they want him to take, right? Like, they're getting the shots that they want him to take. He's just missing them. He is too good for that to continue. He will be better. I think that getting Franklin Howard back is a big deal because Tyus Battle, not a point guard. Jalen Carey, not a point guard. Elijah Hughes, not a point guard. They don't have a point guard on the roster right now, and Franklin Howard has his flaws and has his deficiencies as a basketball player, but he is a point guard, and you can't say anything otherwise for him. So I think that getting him back will help. And I think that, like, all of that combined is part of what happened against UConn, in that, you know, UConn threw a bunch of, they have a bunch of little dudes that are going to get out and guard you and just be pests. And Syracuse didn't have anyone that can handle with that. And Syracuse's defense, like, the zone, the way that it's built, Jim Boeheim wants to keep forcing you farther out and further out and further out and wants you to fire up threes, contested threes, because he has like 6'9" dudes at every single spot on the floor, right? That's what the zone is about. That's what they're trying to make happen. And UConn made a bunch of like 30-footers. If you're Syracuse, what are you going to do if UConn's making 30-footers? If Al-Tariq Gilbert is stepping in and knocking down shots from the logo, like, what are you going to do? There's nothing you could do. You're going to take the L. And, you know, I think it was just one of those nights when it came to the UConn game. But in reality, I think that Syracuse at the end of the day is probably going to end up being fine. It's just, you know, there's going to be some growing pains, especially when you don't have a point guard on the floor.
I don't disagree. What are you, by the way? There are so many freaking good tournaments. Is there like one? I mean, Maui's the obvious one, but this week there's so much good basketball. Like, is there like one thing more than anything else you're excited about? Because I was doing some preview stuff on Monday morning and all that. There's just going to be a lot of really good basketball over the next 7 or 8 days.
Maui's absolutely loaded. Duke, Auburn, Gonzaga. I think that Iowa State, hopefully, I don't think it's going to happen, but if they get Wigginton back, they're a team that's going to be a lot of fun to watch in this event. So Jalen McDaniels is somebody that everybody needs to watch. He might end up being a first-round pick. So I'm really into the Maui. I'm going to be up at the preseason NIT on Wednesday and Friday. That is, I believe, Kansas Marquette in one semifinal, and then Louisville, Tennessee in the other. And then hopefully, you know, basketball gods willing, we can get Kansas, Tennessee in the final on Friday night, which, you know, that would be a hell of a basketball game. That is what I'm hoping for. We'll see if that actually comes to fruition. But yeah, there's a lot of good events, man. The only problem is that some of them, it's gotten a little bit watered down to the point where, like, you kind of have to wait until the last day. Like, you get some juicy matchups in the championship games, but like, we have Villanova playing Canisius in the first round of one of these games. And why am I going to watch that? I'm not going to watch that.
Who I know. Why would they put a nice team like Canisius against a lousy one like Villanova? Oh, too soon.
Got him. That's some Big E shade. Some ex Big E shade. Look at you, Aaron. I see you.
Nah, there's no Big E shade. Lose a Furman shade. That's the shade that I'm seeing right now. But yeah. I was going to say, I agree. I was looking through today, and there are so many tournaments, and I do think the top, you know, several ones are really good, but you know, like the Wooden Legacy is near where I live, and you know, I'm gonna be doing radio all weekend anyway, so I don't know how much I could have gotten to it. But 3-4 years ago, I mean, I remember going 3-4 years ago, Arizona, Michigan State, there was a lot of really good teams. This year it's like Seton Hall and Grand Canyon and LaSalle and Utah. And so I will say that, you know, you get the NIT tip off Maui. You know, Advocare is going to be okay. That's the one with Nova. But even Atlantis, it's like Virginia and Wisconsin. It's not quite as many teams as usual, but I am definitely not complaining. I'm going to enjoy the hell out of this week.
Yes, afternoon basketball to gamble on is is the best and worst thing on the entire planet. So, Aaron, look, man, I've kept you here an hour. I did not mean to keep you an hour. I swear to God, I meant for it to be 30 minutes, but this is just happening whenever. This is what happens every time we get going. So I appreciate the time. If you guys want to follow him, he is Aaron_Torres on Twitter. And tell him where you can find the podcast.
This little website called iTunes has the podcast. So you know, Rob, you come on a lot. I always appreciate what you do. So least I can do is join you. But yeah, the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast, you know, mostly college hoops this time of year. I'll venture into college football or the NBA or whatever's the hot topic. But, you know, I'm a college hoops guy. I love UConn. And so, you know, been following the sport my whole life. So I love it. But follow me on Twitter at Aaron_Torres. And subscribe to the podcast after you're done listening to this one.
Yeah, there you go, man. You hit all the hit everything you need to hit. Yeah,
you got. I told you to subscribe to.
Yeah, it's subscribe to subscribe, unsubscribe, and resubscribe. That's what you got to do. It's the best way to get us.
And rate and review 5 stars only. You know, I say on my show, you can steal this for your show. It's like Uber. Got to give the 5 stars, even if you don't really feel like it's a 5-star experience. It's just bad karma to not give 5 stars. So give Rob 5 stars, give me 5 stars, and all that other stuff. I don't know.
There's zero chance anybody is still listening to the podcast at this point. So so we're gonna call it, man. Listen, Aaron, I do appreciate the time.
All right, Rob. Thank you. Anytime you need me, just tell it.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.